Hey, welcome to another episode of Stuck at Home with my dear friend Scott Belsky, Chief Creative Officer of Adobe, creator of Behance, and all-around good guy. And the reason I'm talking to him is because I need a dose of optimism, and he's one of the most optimistic people I know. Welcome, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I feel like optimism is out of fashion these days, but I still feel hopeful.
Now, you're in New York, which is kind of in a tough spot right now. How are you doing? How's the family doing? And
we're okay. Yeah. We're okay. We are now actually 2.5 hours out of New York City. So we're in Amagansett, which is near Montauk, which is where we come for the summers. So we have a small place here that is not fully winterized, but we are making it work for right now. And I just feel grateful that we're healthy and everyone's okay. And we're getting, the silver lining is a lot of kind of, quality time together that we wouldn't normally have as a family, that's for sure.
I mean, that's the best part of this whole thing, which people don't even seem to appreciate as much, as the family time. Though being a single guy myself, I don't have to experience that myself. I don't know, having kids in the house 24/7, definitely a hard thing for parents to do. How are you keeping them entertained?
We're getting creative on that front. Well, they're learning how to draw. The only plug I'll do in your entire conversation with me is a great illustrator named Kyle Webster, who is one of my colleagues and is just an amazing drawing mastermind. And he's doing this thing twice a week for kids for an hour, teaching them how to draw. And so our kids tune in live, and it's just amazing to see them, learn how to draw with like a live stream over Zoom, of course.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
But we're doing all kinds of things. We're making schedules every day. We are making construction projects out of cardboard from boxes. We are we're doing all kinds of things. And then at night, I'm reading more than I've ever read before. It's just a nice kind of change of pace. But it's also always at the, there's always like this gut of anxiety and fear and, how much do I want to watch the news? And then I have friends who obviously have been afflicted, and some people I know have really been, very, very ill. So there's just a lot of angst.
Yeah. I've given up mostly reading news. I actually ended up subscribing to The Atlantic, and I really love what they're doing as a publication and how they're covering. And so once every evening, I go to the Atlantic website and devote 30 minutes to catch up on what has happened during the day. And in the morning, I read the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post and get the overnight update from them. And that's it. I don't need, that much Twitter. I've restricted my Twitter diet to like 15 minutes a day. And I'm rationing my in and out to Twitter is only to check the DMs.
Yeah, I know it's interesting that, two thoughts. One is I find myself looking at the same stuff over and over again when it comes to social media, which is one reason I like going to kind of the more traditional journalistic driven publications, because at least there's curation and therefore not as much redundancy. Mm-hmm. But I also wonder what products are getting tons of usage now that think they're benefiting, but actually over the long term will be hurt, because we will almost like either we will create a dislike for the product as a result of the overuse of it, or the gravity that product is commanding will gather so many more entrants and competitors in the market that it won't be as good of a business anymore. And I think Twitter, is one of those products where I can see overuse making people have a long-term, problem with the product emotionally. And that's being exacerbated in the day we're living in now. Yeah. And then also when you look at products like Purell and masks and stuff like that, and everyone says, oh, Purell must be so, you know, must be benefiting from all this. And I actually disagree. I feel like over the long term, they'll have more competition than ever before.
I mean, look, so many people are making the, you know, their own versions of Purell, right? Like using alcohol and, you know, gin factories, you know, turning into like, you know, creating cleaning agents and stuff like that. So I definitely think there is an opportunity for other people to come into the market. You know, I saw a bunch of small companies are doing it and probably doing it better using, you know, more natural products. So it's been, you know, my accompanying sitting next to me is this like really age old product because my hands are so dry all the time now.
I know.
From all that washing. So, and I just gave up on all the fancy, you know, creams. It's like, yeah, Vaseline just kind of works. It's, you know, it's kind of not the best smelling, but whatever, you know, it just works. And
very functional. And well, before. Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah. And it was easy to find it. I mean, like everybody is so busy buying all the fancy stuff. So I just went and bought it like $3 and it's going to last me like for a long time. The thing which you were talking about, Twitter, I think what we are seeing is it's exposing the algorithmic shortcomings of these platforms, whether it's Facebook, Google, Instagram. The engagement-driven business model they have adapted is a problem. Like, that's why we keep seeing the same things again and again, because they believe that people want to see the same things again and again instead of actually being curator of the latest and the most accurate. And I think if Twitter needs to evolve and survive, it has to kind of figure out how to do that. And so far, they've just proven to be pretty incompetent on that front.
Well, as you know, I'm hopeful. I know some good people there who are very passionate about bringing that kind of topic-driven product experience into Twitter. And I do think that if we could proactively and easily and often inform Twitter of what topics are interesting to us, that it's a great system to get the world's experts on those topics to curate what's interesting to them, which then of course enriches us. I think the problem is that with a lowest common denominator algorithm for everyone and everyone's, you know, or even like one algorithm, you know, an algorithm that's tuned for personalization for an individual by individual basis, your fears, it's like a Maslow's hierarchy driving the algorithmic recommendations. Of course, you're always going to end up looking at the stuff that makes you afraid and the stuff that you're worried about at the expense of the topics that you're passionate about. And what are we doing to ourselves?
I think the challenge is that they have such weak inputs into their, you know, into their profiles, and it really hasn't been built to actually be ready for a future they're now confronting. It was a pretty simple system, and it started off like being anonymous, and it didn't really care about a lot of things. The fact that, you know, even today you can set up an account without thinking, you know, like there isn't really any barriers to it. And like, you know, so suddenly if you're looking at the quality of, you know, the tweets coming out from a person, and it's all like there isn't really an ability to recognize what is right and valid and what is not. And, you know, the blue check mark is not enough. And, you know, there's a lot of people, like they deprecated people's ability to create lists, which could have been a manual, you know, verification system in a way. Wikipedia is a manual verification system for Google, right? Like it validates a lot of data on the web. And I think that's a challenge, you know, with Twitter, is that they haven't really figured out what are the key things to enhance in order for to let even 2% of the community to help them shape a better Twitter. And I think all that thinking is gone from the company. I just think they're just so focused on being, you know, keeping the lights on and being engagement driven that they're not thinking long-term, you know, value proposition. At least, you know, that's what it seems like from the outside. You know, I don't really go and explore Twitter as much as I used to because not my day job, but you know, that's one of the questions I would ask that product team is like, what are you doing to help enhance the data inputs, right? Like validate data inputs. So, you know, if there is, I have 25 lists, I have designers and I created a COVID list, I created a scientist list, I created a doctor's list. Like, again, you know, the list didn't have as any VCs talking about, you know, the pandemic. It was only doctors and scientists talking about it. That's a pretty valid group of people to get signals from, right? Like what information they're sharing, what they're talking about, what the links they're sharing. So there is a signal out there. They just have not made it easy for curators like me to actually help, you know, help them. I think that's why I think you see the, you know, something like Pinterest is much more accurate on a lot of things is because it takes a lot of human curation and kind of marries it perfectly with the machine. And I think that's the key thing.
I think it's a great insight. And I think the it's sort of a shame because it's at their fingertips. I mean, there are people in the system who are investing deeply in curating what's interesting to them and spending the time that should then inform the other 90% of the people who don't care to spend the time, but have the same interests and just want to see the same content. It's a lot. It's a frustrating saga that I have had in a love-hate relationship with Twitter over many years. And I've had, you know, I was really close with the Periscope team. And so I continue to be close with Kayvon and a few folks there who are now in the product organization. And I know that they're not short on some of these ideas that we're discussing. I do wonder if the gravity of the operations of the organization, and to your point, like always the pressing matter at hand. I mean, I was sort of bummed when I heard that one of the number one priorities was trust and safety. I mean, yes, that's important for an organization like Twitter, but how can that be like the singular focus for a product organization? Doesn't it also have to be like what the future is and why is there not as much gravity around that?
I mean, you know, I have seen this, I've been on all sides of the table. So when I look at this, I'm like, you guys have like close to 5,000 people working for the company. I mean, that's not like, you know, like you're not a tiny startup, right? You have a lot of teams and there should be a lot of parallel things which need to happen to enhance the product, you know, experience. And, you know, I think this crisis has actually exposed their weaknesses and their benefits. I would be wrong to say that there are no benefits. You know, there has been amazing upside of Twitter. Like, you know, the other day, one friend of mine connected me to an ER doctor who wanted help basically with a way to communicate with other doctors in other places where there was the pandemic had spread and how they were dealing situation. And they didn't have a really smooth way of communicating other than using like, you know, WhatsApp and Facebook. And so I just sent out one tweet, you know, 10 minutes later, there was a group of 10 people. 2 or 3 days later, there was a beta product working on Slack. And 5 days later, it was launched and there's like 3,500 doctors on it. And you know, it's like, so I can't say Twitter is all bad. It just, when it works really, really well. I think it just is that at the scale where they are, I think they really do need to kind of think different. Like, I just don't think, you know, there is, you know, but I still, if I have to take Twitter over Facebook, I will take Twitter.
Anyway. Oh yeah. Well, that's the funny thing is where everyone loves to complain about Twitter because they're using it all day. A lot of people, I mean, it's probably the digital product I owe the most to in my professional life, in terms of learning from people, meeting people, getting opportunities, sharing things that I've been working on, getting support. So I think it's, you know, it's criticism driven by excitement of the potential. But I think to your point, you know, one of the things I've always believed is that every playbook is right until it's wrong. And companies, the more successful they are, the harder it is to discard the playbook that worked. And yeah, what a great example. I mean, Twitter was the perfect product for whatever, 150 million people or so who are willing to actually painfully go through and build their following person by person by person to the point where they had a good stream of content. And then everyone else just came and wanted news and wanted to find interesting, timely information on stuff that's interesting to them. And the product didn't really make the leap to embrace these people that were more topic driven as opposed to account and building their own timeline driven. And you know, the right playbook became the wrong one. And that's, I think, where the business is still trying to break out from.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting challenge they have. I think it's not just them. I think this, you know, forget be looking beyond the economic impact of this pandemic and, you know, the economic impact of that, which will have on startups. It would be interesting to see how people think differently about their products and, more importantly, their value propositions. You know, I think this is going to be a time of like a lot of self-reflection for a bunch of companies. I had this company, I saw the news that DoorDash is now doing grocery deliveries. And I said, wow, that's being nimble, right? Like reacting to the market. Yep. You know? I mean, Grubhub can't do that, right? It's essentially, and DoorDash can, the name says DoorDash, it doesn't say what you're DoorDashing, right? And I think that was a good move on their part, you know? I think,
the number of pivot idea emails I've gotten in the last 3 weeks from entrepreneurs, in some ways made me feel like this has been a forcing function for them to act upon something that they knew wasn't really working and now realize it's either like now or never. So in some weird way, hopefully these companies find their way faster now. And yeah, I mean, when the set of things we all care about gets a lot smaller, it's an interesting time for new products to emerge, for a lot of superfluous products to disappear, the ones that we probably never needed. I think but it's hard. I mean, I think that every team that I know is facing the question of how do we make this, how do we hold ourselves over? Very few exceptions.
You know, you're a product guy and you love behaviors. You love looking at behaviors and how they shape who we are. What's your take on the behaviors we are indulging in right now? Whether it's like, you know, being on Zoom all the time, ordering in online and yada, yada, yada. What are the things you think will stick after, you know, some kind of semblance of normality returns?
No, I think there's the short-lived things and then there's the longer-term things. I'm hopeful that on the short-term basis, there's a lot more kind of unification. Like we're all kind of connected. We're all suffering a common problem that leads to some interesting behavior changes, maybe increased amounts of empathy on, of course, the areas of politics and health and well-being. I mean, I think it's fascinating that so many people that were so against any social welfare system or any means of the government taking care of its people suddenly applying for loans from the government and trying to get the government to help them through this difficult period in their lives, as if now it's okay, but it wasn't before. I'm hopeful that some of these, maybe I'm too optimistic as you started this call with, but that some of these things will stay. Over the long term, I believe there's like 10 years of acceleration on certain areas of like what it's like to have a remote workforce. There are a lot of CEOs out there who just never even adopted anything beyond email and suddenly were forced into it, probably after years of hearing that they should try it, but neglecting to take the plunge. And then suddenly now everyone's forced to do something in an entirely new way. And of course there will be a snapback, but people's minds will be evolved 5 to 10 years of, in terms of what's possible in their norms as a culture and performance management and measuring productivity. And I mean, there's just so many things that were just forced upon us that must have a massive impact on our willingness to adopt. I think I also wonder what the impact is for things like virtual conferences and concerts and virtual experiences. I mean, remember, it wasn't too long ago when Marshmallow did that concert in Fortnite. Yeah. And everyone thought it was like the most amazing and cool, but also like on the edge thing. And now every Thursday night, we're watching like someone live in their living room, sponsored by Verizon. I just think that there's like this massive, you know, increase in velocity of some of these new kind of our willingness to do some of these new experiences.
Right. I think the other is the same day streaming of movies. You know, $20, watch the movie at home.
Yeah.
I mean, my point is, why not? Like, why do I? Like, I've always argued against what a waste of space to have theaters. It's like, you know, I definitely agree that not having shopping malls is kind of counterproductive for a society, but not having movie theaters, that's fine. You know, it's like it's not as communal an experience as we like to make it to be, because, but I love the idea of being able to see a movie at home. I probably see more movies because I don't want to go somewhere and it just is easier.
I've always been an introvert, and so sometimes I wonder if this is sort of an introvert's moment to shine in some ways.
Actually, that is not true. I read a recent research somewhere which said that introverts, even though they like the isolation, they actually suffer more in isolation than most people, because introverts need to actually interact with people, not maybe talk to them as much, but more like, you know, they need the physical presence more than anything else. So, I'm reading all these weird things right now. I have more time to read than ever before. So it's like my media diet actually has become better. It's changed so much from reading news. But anyway, I just think it would be great to see movies the same day they're supposed to be released. You know, it's like we can get the music album streamed the day they're released, so why not the movies? It's like, it's no difference.
I think things like that. I think the tolerance of distance learning, I mean, it's so obvious, and there have been so many schools, universities that just have shunned this notion of distance learning, and you know, they wouldn't even give people real degrees if they weren't actually physically in the classrooms. And I think that that's going to change, because now they're all forced into, you know, it would be hypocritical for them to now say that you can't get a good education if you're not there physically, if they're obviously all forced to deliver their curriculums digitally. Mm-hmm. I think the ways that we parent and fill our children's time, the way that we interview and sell and present, I think have all changed. I think there was this insistence that we had to travel on planes to sell and to close deals. You had to meet people in order to hire them. I mean, that was one of the biggest debates we had with a group of folks at Adobe, because, you know, it was one thing to all work from home, but then the question of, can we hire people? Before we all are back in the office, and there was this discomfort of, I don't think we've ever actually hired somebody that we've never met. And then the question is, well, what does meeting mean? Why do you have to physically be in the same room as someone for us to feel like we're getting some data about them?
Yeah. I think, in my profession is exactly the same thing. It's like, how do you fund somebody you've never met?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like a lot of money you're giving somebody. I think a lot of it is if this behavior of like interacting, you know, virtually online becomes more pervasive, I think it will come at the cost of giving up more privacy, because we will have to replace, you know, like the personal interaction with more more information, more like, more, you know, how do I know who you are, right? Like, we just need more data. Like, so there'll be like more background checks and more looking into people's, you know. So you'll have to replace, databases will replace the trust you normally have. Because a lot of the things we do in the Valley, at least in my time in the Valley, has been based on trust, right? Like, oh, okay, so-and-so introduced us and we're doing that. So a lot of it is social validation, but we would probably have to add another layer or two beyond social validation, right? Like, it would be actual.
I mean, to play it out, sometimes we equate trust to having a relationship with somebody. And then we say that a relationship is based on the physical time and the circumstantial time we've had together. And I've always subscribed to that to some degree, but there's also one part of me that wonders if that's kind of if that's the equivalent of talking about culture fit and saying, well, actually culture fit is really just, is this person like me? Do they look like me? And realizing that that's actually the wrong term to use when you're hiring for, right, you know, for the eclectic clash of differences and the innovation that comes out of such an environment. And so then you have to wonder if maybe this remote way of working is an equalizer of sorts. Like, maybe, you know, the fact that I can't, you know, take you to dinner and then take you to a game and then get to know you better and have a better relationship with you so that you then feel you trust me more, and I get some advantage, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing from a meritocracy perspective?
So I think the Europeans have it right. Like, they don't think of, if they work with you, you're not really their friend. Mm-hmm. Whereas in US, we conflate people we work with as people we are friends with. And it was like, no, not really. You work with somebody, you go home and they do their thing and you do yours. I think from that standpoint, I felt all my European friends were a little bit more, you know, evolved. And so probably we end up doing things that way. I know Matt Mullenweg's company has been like distributed for the longest time. And, you know, they don't have any of those things. Just like, they definitely meet face to face, you know, pretty often, but in small teams. So it's like, so that'd be an interesting, I hope that behavior sticks, because I'm a big believer in remote work and distributed teams. And I hate the idea of being dogmatic about being in one location, you know. I mean, as an industry, we have always preached the disruptive power of the internet as long as it doesn't disrupt investing and running our companies. They need to be in the backyard.
I wonder how long we have to all be remote forcibly in this way until investors stop asking founders, where are you based? I mean, right now there's still obviously the Silicon Valley, you know, gravity. And I know a lot of firms who only invest in that area, and anything, even New York, is like an exception to the rule. And in this day and age where we're living the way we're living, like, it's kind of a joke.
I think the other thing which I think it's more than you and I, and more than how we are going to adapt to all this reality, your kids are growing up with, basically, they understand something weird is going on in the planet.
Yeah.
That mom and dad are at home and we are living in this place, we don't have school, and we are doing all these things through a screen. This probably is how the future is going to look like to many of the kids. I think they are the ones who are going to learn more from this than you and I. Mm. I think we have enough dogma in our life to not actually appreciate that this is a learning moment. We won't, you know.
I think that's true. I mean, I'm seeing that firsthand right now. But the whole conversation also makes me wonder, you know, once our life goes back to once we're in the post-virus world where we are safely able to go anywhere, even if a lot of these tendencies stick, more and more companies are remote friendly or remote first, I wonder then if, you know, how does the in-person experience evolve? You know, right now we go to conferences and we all just sit in seats and we watch what is the equivalent of a screen, because it's so far away, we can't touch it anyways, nor can we interact with it. And then we leave the main area and then maybe we have chance collisions with each other that are ultimately the value that brings us back next time. Yeah. And so you have to wonder if we'll realize that. And therefore maybe, you know, maybe you'll sign up for a conference and you'll get an email saying, so here's all the videos to watch, watch them before you come. And then we're going to spend the whole day socializing and mixing groups of people on purpose. And then that's the conference.
Yeah, that would be my idea of a conference. That's what I've been thinking about for the longest time. I don't think the traditional conference is done. I think anyone who's trying to do that makes no sense. You know, whenever I used to do, and I used to do a lot of conferences, and like if there is one thing I miss, is the 3 hours after the day was over. Because before that, it was just like content. But connection was between 5 and 8. You would have cocktails, you would have dinners, people would meet each other. And I would love introducing people to each other. And I just enjoyed that aspect of it. You know, the challenge is like, how do we overcome, you know, this weird trust issue, which is like, what disease are you carrying now? That's also part of it, like in your head right now. Like, I don't want to shake your hand. I don't want to sit next to you. So, you know, it's like, what if that behavior sticks, man? That's pretty anti-human behavior.
Yeah, I guess other than us all having a vaccine and feeling carefree, and I'm not even sure that that's going to happen. I mean, the flu was, the vaccine protects like 20% of the flu strains. I'm not sure how we will have a carefree, you know, roaming existence after this, but.
Yeah, no shaking hands, which is right. Okay.
And also, I mean, I was thinking about it from the hotel industry perspective. Once this whole thing is over, where would you rather go? To a big crowded resort or hotel or an Airbnb where you know you're alone?
Yeah, this is why I've been enjoying the overreaction to Airbnb, and it's like, No, if we have less money, we are not going to big hotels, which have high fixed costs. We're going to go to apartments, which have one room, which is more affordable. And I think if we are going to be more frugal, that seems to be a better way of doing things. I think, you know, it will be a much skinnier Airbnb. It cannot be, you know, an Airbnb of all those professional Airbnb operations. It could be, you know, Airbnb back to being mom and pop Airbnb, which is nothing wrong with that. I think it's a great idea that, you know, the original premise of the company is still valid. I think the value of Airbnb doesn't go away, and even in post-pandemic world. So I think that company is going to be fine.
I also wonder if there's going to be a, what will this whole ordeal do to personal health? And people's awareness of their own health, the quantified self movement, and the latest incarnations of that, like the Oura Ring or the Apple Watch, and people kind of understanding themselves. I think that there's a surge of interest in it right now.
You know, definitely there's going to be an, you know, I don't have an Oura Ring, but like I should have ordered one before this thing started, right? Like, I didn't do a good job of doing that. But I do feel that it would have been useful to track my sleep, because I know I'm not sleeping well. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the key thing.
I don't know what, you know, I've been wearing it for a while at night, and it just gives me like a psychological incentive to stop watching something earlier, to put the phone down, because, or to not drink alcohol as close to bedtime, because it, you know, you see the correlations. You know, you'll wake up one morning and you'll realize your REM sleep is, you know, half of what it typically is, and it's a red as opposed to a green line. And then you touch it and it reminds you that if you drink alcohol or whatever before bed, like this is an impact on your REM. And it's...
Yeah. Well, that is true. I think a lot of changes coming our way. How's your... what are you thinking about Behance these days? I mean, I've been loving it. Like I'm spending a lot of time there, finding a lot of creative stuff going on there. I don't know what are you doing on Behance?
Behance is another kind of, I continue to go every day for some dose of inspiration. I mean, there are people that I've been following on Behance for now since since literally day one. And some of them are still active. And it's, Behance has also tried to carefully think about the role of algorithms and take in a different view of, it's not about seeing stuff within your vertical. You know, we don't want all photographers to only see photography. So the algorithm has tried to make sure you see photography you might be interested in, but also, and I don't know if you notice this in the product, but you're exposed to a lot of stuff like beyond your interest area that is also deemed good enough by other people that are credible in those areas. And so, hopefully you're getting that experience where when you come, you just like, there's never any stream of high quality work but isn't all the obvious stuff that you'd want to see based on your own creative work.
I mean, I'm loving 3D models. I also like the fact that there is people from other countries.
Oh yeah.
Not just the West. I think there is people from China, new talent from India, new talent from Indonesia, and Malaysia. I mean, I just find that completely the texture of their artistic capabilities is like so local, and like I've been enjoying that. And I think, you know, I don't know who was that, like from where they were, but there were some 3D illustrations of dragons, and I was just like, but they were not Game of Thrones dragons, right? Like they were like very Asian in their flavor. And you could just say like, I can appreciate this even more today than I did before Game of Thrones. So, you know, I didn't know the difference, and I think Behance opens a lot of those ideas. And like for me personally, as a photographer, I find like a lot of people who are doing these illustrations as a bunch of people who are inspiring me to make better pictures.
I think a few things over the years have changed. First of all, well, it's remained very international. So Behance was always over 60% international, less than 40 domestic. That's held. A lot of students, like the demographic in Behance, you know, has stayed, has continued to engage the next generation, which is good. Because that was always one of my fears, was that the products users would just age together, but we wouldn't be able to get a lot of the kind of next generation of talent in there.
Yeah.
Now it's 23 million creatives around the world. All-time high engagement numbers now. I think that there's still like a real relevance. And also whenever there's like a calamity, I remember when the Japan earthquake happened many years ago, the big earthquake, Behance suddenly, like tons of people from all over started creating work in response to the crisis. Whether it was to raise money or just on their own, like illustrations, just because it was on their mind. And it's interesting, like when you see the creative world at work, you also see them internalizing the world's events with their craft. And you see how it impacts like what they're doing and what they're sharing. And it's and that lasts. And I think we're going to see that now.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. So, Scott, I know I'm running up on my allotted time. Thank you so much. It was great to catch up with you. And let's do it again. And let's talk more about our world, hopefully soon. I know we've got another 4 weeks of being at home, so I can catch you at least one more time before we're done.
Anytime.
Thanks, brother. Stay safe. Give my love to the family. And, you know, one of the things which I didn't tell you is that This is the most I have seen you with the longest hair ever.
Well, I'm not exactly getting a haircut, so
exactly.
Yeah,
so
this is as good as it gets. That's another thing that's changed is like fashion. I mean, who's buying anything uncomfortable now? Everyone's just in their ultimate comfort garb.
I'm about to put out a blog post next week on my favorite stay-at-home clothes, beard oils, and socks. it's like that's my idea of high fashion these days.
It's great. I mean, I've never like craved a good pair of slippers more than I do right now. So it's
I got you, man. I got you. I got some names for you.
All right.
All right, brother. Take care, brother. Be good.
All right. Bye. Thank you.